available within 24 hours on the Minnesota Judicial Branch's website. So with that, Marshall, please call the next case.
This is case number A220569 in the matter of the welfare of the child of AML, Commissioner of Human Services, legal custodian.
Thank you. Council, as you probably know, you will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and Council for Appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer on the center podium. You can adjust the height of the podium as well. I think some of the folks we had this morning were a bit taller. So that will reset when you have the beginning of your argument to the total time you have. And at the beginning, please introduce yourself and identify your client so the recording is clear. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Good. Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Your Honors, for having me here today. My name is Rachel Osband, and I represent the appellants in this case, AC and RC. I'd like to start with a quote from the case of BLW, which was decided by this court last year in 2021. In BLW, the court, citing Minnesota Statute Section 260C.001, wrote, "One of the enumerated purposes of Chapter 260C is to, quote, preserve and strengthen the child's family ties wherever possible." I submit that the district court did the exact opposite in this case. We have a case here where an infant has been permanently separated from his one full biological sibling. A biological sibling is the closest family tie that a child in foster care has once their parents' rights have been terminated. This child has been denied the right to live with, to grow up with, to bond with, and to be a true sibling to his sister. And I submit that the court abused its discretion when it erroneously determined that there was no sibling preference to apply in this case, and that the sibling preference under the law was usurped by a best interest analysis. We had extensive testimony from one of the experts, Ms. Samina Gordon, explaining how the sibling preference actually supports each element of the best interest of the child. That the sibling relationship is a protective factor. And I think that that is borne out particularly by the Sibling Bill of Rights, which is codified in Minnesota. And that Sibling Bill of Rights exists because children who had experienced separation in foster care came forward and said, it is our right. It is the right of the child to be placed with their siblings. This is the one right that is given to children under our laws in 260C. There is no other Bill of Rights for any other relative other than siblings. And I think that this voice of the children coming forward and saying, our experience is, we needed this. This would have helped us, is borne out by the research, which was also discussed by Ms. Gordon and completely ignored by the district court, and by the other rules in 260C, which recognize the importance of placing children together at the earliest possible time, as well as by many other states, which is addressed in both our reply brief and I believe our initial brief. In failing to recognize the importance of this sibling placement, this court has separated these children by miles and by states. One is in Colorado, one is in Minnesota. And not only is that placement with his sister in Colorado, but appellants are also closely related to the child in this case. They are the direct maternal great aunt and uncle of the child. They had placement of the sister through foster care from another county, and they have been committed to the welfare of that child and also to JB in this case. So I submit to this court that the court's decision to completely ignore the sibling preference, which is found throughout 263, was a complete error of law and an abuse of discretion by the court, which requires reversing this trial court's decision. Beyond that, I would also note that the trial court's decision must...
Did the trial court completely ignore the sibling preference, or did the trial court consider the sibling preference but also the best interests of the child?
What the trial court wrote in its order, Your Honor, is that it is both the placement with a sibling is both a factor and a preference. But then it goes on to say that a preference is only a preference and that the court will not blindly follow that. Yet, in doing so, the court fails to take into account the import of that preference on the child's best interests. It fails to recognize how the protective factor of being raised with a sibling impacts a child's developmental health, its physical health, its connections with family and relatives, and that child's own sense of identity as they grow. These were all evidentiary pieces that were completely ignored and not addressed by the court in its best interest findings.
So, counsel, to agree with you and reverse, would this court have to determine that no, based on the evidence in this record, no reasonable decision maker could have awarded, approved the placement, the permanent placement with respondent?
I don't believe that it's no reasonable decision maker, Your Honor. I believe that the finding must be that there was an improper application of the law.
Well, help me out there then. I hear that you're trying to make that argument, but it also sounds like you're suggesting the evidence goes all one way. And that's not what, I don't read the evidence as going all one way. You certainly made a case, and that was recognized by the district court. So if the evidence does go somewhat both ways, then help me out. Where's the legal error here?
Well, I believe that the legal error is in finding that the sibling preference is not a preference in the way that it is stated under the law, that children are to be placed together at the earliest possible opportunity, that under the Sibling Bill of Rights, they have the right to be placed together or in close proximity, that they have a right to have a say in the placement of their siblings. Everything that is laid out in the Sibling Bill of Rights.
It makes it sound like you're suggesting the sibling preference is really a trump card.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that it is in a way, just as what we have, this court has found is the relative preference. Because in order to find that siblings should not be placed together, there's a higher standard. It must be shown that it is contrary to the health and well-being of the child, or that there's a safety concern. It's a higher standard under the statute. 260C.212, Subdivision 2D says that siblings must be placed together at the earliest possible time unless it's documented that it's contrary to the safety and well-being or not possible after reasonable efforts. So now, guardian ad litem argued that these shouldn't apply because these two children were not placed in foster care at the same time. Mm-hmm. But that issue, I would say, is a red herring, and I think really does a disservice to children who are placed in the system, because in this case, the older child was adopted about a year or two before the younger child was even born. So to say that your right to being placed with your sibling doesn't exist just because the adoption happened before you were born seems completely antithetical to the entire purpose behind the sibling preferences. And again, Ms. Gordon testified extensively about why these preferences are important to children in foster care and to their long-term protective identity.
So, Counselor, my understanding of the record, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that when the child was removed initially, that the father's rights weren't terminated immediately, and therefore the county had an obligation to make active efforts towards reunification with that parent. And if the child had been placed in Colorado as opposed to remaining here in Minnesota, it's not clear to me how the county could have achieved that.
And that's a valid question, Your Honor. I think part of the issue we have here is the way in which this was done, which goes to the record that is actually established at trial versus what is reflected in the court's order. Now, we submit that the court's order very closely tracks with the county's case. While the evidence presented at trial shows that there are many misrepresentations and falsehoods to what the county stated to the court, what it put in its court report, and I think it's important to make this court aware that at the end of this 7-day trial, the district court asked to go off the record and chastise the county harshly for its failure to involve the relatives, its failure to achieve a timely ICPC, its failure to do what it was supposed to do under the law, chastise the guardian ad litem for failing to have any contact with appellants, for doing any independent investigation, apologize to the appellants for what they had been through and for how they had been treated and how their child had been treated. And even so that the court itself was taking this up to the CJI to figure out what went wrong, that clearly this needed to be autopsied because things were missed. Now, when we get the order, it says there was, you know, basically bias, favoritism towards the foster parents, that this was not, you know, the shining moment, that procedures weren't followed, but somehow that's all okay because the foster placement ended up being fine. And I argue that that is not the standard. And if that's the way that foster care cases are going to be moving forward, then we need a very different set of statutes because this is not a direct adoption. This is a foster care adoption. And the relative search statutes and the relative involvement requirements are very clearly laid out and were completely missed in this case. So to answer your question, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I kind of went off on a tangent. But to answer your question, there were no real active efforts. There was never a visit between the child and either birth parent. The county was aware by March of father's contact information and did nothing until June. When they did establish paternity, the father contacted the county affirmatively at least twice to say he should be placed with his sister in Colorado. There was never a case plan set up for father that was followed. There were never any visits that happened. So to say that the county needed time to execute a case plan is somewhat of a smokescreen because there was no engagement from parents. But even if that were the case, concurrent planning, as the court is aware, needs to be happening, right? It's a two-phase or a two-fold effort. There must be, you know, reunification efforts with parents and concurrent planning with relatives.
And I guess it's my understanding as well that when they were doing the relative search in February, I think it was, of 2021, that they had, in fact, identified your clients, and they then pursued the process to have them, you know, essentially approved as a placement through the interstate compact, and that also took time, and there were records that weren't available that needed to go with that application, and that was part of the reason why there was perhaps a delay or a longer period of time that the child was placed with the foster placement.
That was the representation to the county, but at trial, through cross-examination and through presentation of emails, texts, and actual documentation, what came out was that the caseworker had initiated the ICPC in March or April and then stopped the process. And there were multiple reasons given why the process was just stopped. None of them are actually borne out by the evidence, and I encourage the court to reread our initial brief because it walks through each piece of this. But the ICPC was stopped without any information being given to our clients or the court for months. And at trial, it was stated that this was because of records. But the documentation shows that those records weren't actually requested until July. And when foster parents requested the same records for the trial, they testified it took them about a week or two to get. And these were not records that were crucial to any health piece of the child. They were records about his helmet wearing and how well the, you know, the child had done with the helmet. It was not about any major illness. It was not about any major special need, anything that would hold up an ICPC process. And then the ICPC was not actually initiated again until August, after the court required them to do so. And with that initial, well, when it was finally submitted to Colorado in August, there was a two-page letter sent from the social worker talking about how well this child was doing with the foster parents, how the child should stay with the foster parents, basically advocating that the ICPC was, you know, a formality that didn't need to happen. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, please continue.
I will also note that there's talk that the ICPC was stopped for a consent to adopt. Again, you'll see in our brief, there were no true discussions about that. There was one email from the public defender from Mother saying that the public defender was open to a discussion about it. There was never a communication from Mother. There was never a draft consent to adopt. There was never any communication with the worker and the mother. The worker testified that she had not had any conversations with the mother during that period or any conversations about the consent to adopt. So a lot of these, as I was saying, are kind of smoke screens that were thrown up to say, well, we have to do this and we have to do this. And meanwhile, on the back end, there was planning about how this child should be placed with the foster family and stay with the foster family. And these are the concerns we have about appellants, but nobody called appellants. Nobody asked appellant about those concerns. Nobody did anything to affirmatively find out what is the truth here, other than what we are hearing from maternal grandmother and now foster parents. I see my time is up.
Sometimes the time goes quite fast. So thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And next we'll turn to counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Christensen, Assistant Carver County Attorney, and I appear today on behalf of Respondent Carver County Health and Human Services. I would note that Ms. Eisenmenger, counsel for respondents SS and TS, and I are going to share our time this morning as we are both respondents to this case. My time will focus on the district court's determination that the agency was reasonable in not placing the child in the home of the appellants, because the agency was required to make reasonable efforts to finalize the adoption of the child, and also to address the district court's findings and conclusions of law that the agency was reasonable in not placing the child with appellant. Ms. Eisenmenger is going to address the individualized determination of the child's needs and how respondents SS and TS would best serve those needs while considering the sibling placement preference. And she also will address the court's consideration of the best interest factors. The matter that's before you here today involves the adoption of an almost two-year-old child who has resided with respondents SS and TS for primarily most of his life. Within a matter of weeks of him being removed from the care and custody of his mother, he began having contact and visits with respondents through their efforts and desire to be engaged in his life. His parents' rights have now been terminated for over 12 months, yet he awaits finalization of adoption. In this case, the district court considered whether the agency was reasonable in not placing the child with appellants and determined that it was. The district court, I submit, did not abuse its discretion in making that finding. I think it's most important that we view this case in the lens that the paramount consideration in all child protection cases must be the best interest, health, and welfare of the child. I believe we must not lose sight of that, that this is about the child's best interest and not about the rights of relatives. Appellants in this case filed a motion for adoptive placement, and the court granted their request for their motion for an evidentiary hearing, which occurred over 7 days. The court found that social services made efforts to finalize the adoption of this child. In doing so, those efforts, the agency must make a placement in a home using the placement considerations set forth in statute. That must be with a relative or a foster provider who also can be a concurrent permanent home for the child. Social services is directed to the placement preference set out in Minnesota Statute 260C.212, Subdivision 2, Paren B, requiring the agency to first place a child with an individual who is related to the child by blood, marriage, or adoption. And the second prong of that would be, or with an individual who's an important friend with whom the child has resided. In this case, both appellants and respondents, SS, and TS, are relatives of this child. I think it is important to point out that appellants refer to respondents SS and TS repeatedly as merely foster relatives. I'm sorry, as merely foster home and not relatives, when they are equally relatives under the eyes of the law. Counsel for appellants just today indicated that the statutory directive is to preserve and strengthen family ties. Yet that is what this placement does, as respondents SS and TS are relatives of the child and have maintained family ties with the majority of his biological family who remain in the state of Minnesota. Social services made numerous efforts in this case to finalize the adoptive placement of this child, including a relative search, remaining in contact with all four relative placement homes who indicated that they could be a permanent placement option for this child. They gathered information from all of those permanency options, held agency-wide consults, received information and input from the guardian ad litem. When they decided they didn't have enough information, they submitted a second questionnaire to the permanent placement options so that they could ensure that they could gather all of the information and make an individualized determination as to what permanency placement was in the best interest of this child.
So, Counsel, I apologize for interrupting you. I can tell you're doing a very helpful job of summarizing the sort of, you know, step-by-step approach the county took to determine appropriate placement. But what I haven't heard you say, and I do see your time going really quickly, is how the sibling preference was factored in by the county. I mean, you headed right to relative, which really helped me, but you haven't talked about the sibling.
Yes, and I do want to defer to Ms. Eisenmenger, who is going to be...
Well, but don't the county's efforts have to reflect as well? I mean, you're here to defend the county, right?
And I submit that the county absolutely considered that and that the evidence and testimony at trial suggested at the first possible moment of this case being transferred to the ongoing case manager, she was made aware and was aware that the child had a full-blooded sibling. At the time, only knew that it was a half-sibling, that they shared the same mother, but was aware that that child was in Colorado. But social services could not, at that time, reasonably make a recommendation for that child to be placed with his sibling in Colorado, given the requirement to utilize ICPC, but more importantly, their legal obligation and requirement to exercise reasonable efforts to reunify this child with both his mother or with his father. At no time during this case was the agency relieved of making efforts to reunify this child with his parents. I believe the mother's rights were terminated in June of 2021, and the father's rights were terminated in August of 2021, some 8 months after this child was placed in out-of-home placement.
Counsel, I recognize that, and that's an important point, but appellant argues that during that time period, the county wasn't making diligent efforts to, forward the ICPC process, in the ICPC process. Can you address that argument?
Yes, I believe the testimony at trial that the court would find in the transcript is that they had been in contact with the Minnesota Department of Human Services ICPC program, who said it is reasonable and should be waited for those records, as the ICPC would not move forward without having all of the medical records for the child. And that information...
The record reflect why there was such a delay in getting the medical records?
I only can recite, I was not the attorney of record at trial, but I certainly can recite to the transcript where the testimony from Health and Human Services was that they were informed by the hospital that there were significant delays in providing records to agencies as a result of COVID, and that drastically reduced their ability to respond to those requests for records.
Thank you.
And I note that my time appears to be finished, so I will defer to Ms. Eisenmenger.
Thank you. The clock is reset. It was 7 minutes and 30 seconds. And counsel, you may begin when you are ready.
I apologize. I'm a little bit taller than everybody else. If it may please the court, my name is Jenna Eisenmenger, and I represent respondents SS and TS. Since Ms. Christensen has already addressed our request to affirm the district court's decision regarding the county's reasonableness, I will only be addressing the remaining requests to find, number one, that the district court correctly applied the law with regard to the foster care sibling bill of rights, and number two, that the district court did not abuse its discretion in determining that it was in the child's best interest to be placed for adoption with my clients instead of with appellants. In reviewing adoptive placements, this court shall determine whether the district court abused its discretion by making findings unsupported by the evidence or by improperly applying the law. Our argument today is that that did not occur and the court therefore did not abuse its discretion. With respect to the Foster Care Sibling Bill of Rights, Minnesota Statute 260C.008, Subdivision 1, spells out a statement of rights for siblings placed in foster care. Further down in that same statute, under Subdivision 2, there is an interpretation of this Bill of Rights that describes the purpose of this statute as the rights under this section are established for the benefit of siblings in foster care. We must look at the plain language of this statute to interpret its intent, which appears to be to avoid, when possible, separating siblings who are being placed in foster care together and who were together prior to being placed in foster care. That is not the case here. AMC was not in foster care at the same time as JB, as AMC was adopted by appellants in 2018, approximately 2 years before JB's birth.
Counsel, do you have any cases that you can provide to us that support that contention?
Not at the tip of my fingers, Your Honor. I do believe, however, that when there is not case law, we do have to look at that interpretation, and this is what we are seeing, as the plain language says, for the benefits of sibling and foster care. We believe, therefore, that the Foster Care Sibling Bill of Rights does not apply in this case, as the siblings were never in foster care together. Regardless, even if the district court were to determine that the Foster Care Sibling Bill of Rights were to apply, the laws do not mandate that JB be placed in the same home as AMC, as appellants assert. The district court also did not abuse its discretion in determining that it is in JB's best interest to be placed for adoption with respondents instead of appellants, as the district court properly applied the law and made findings supported by the evidence. With respect to properly applying the law, this court, as well as the Minnesota Supreme Court, has repeatedly analyzed sibling and relative preference over the last few decades with respect to matters such as this. The Supreme Court analyzed sibling and relative preference in 1994 and 1996 by clarifying that a preference is only a preference. It is not a commandment to be followed blindly or mechanically, irrespective of the particular needs of individual children. And also, it is not to be applied so as to override the overall best interests of the child. In 2004, this court concluded that the best interests of the child take priority over any other statutory consideration. In 2010, Minnesota Statute 259.29 was amended to add that the state's policy is to ensure that the best interests of children are met by requiring an individualized determination of the needs of the child. Even opposing counsel for appellants indicated today that a sibling preference would not be considered if it is not in the best interest of the child. It is very clear that the intent of the legislature is to continue to move away from any preference and instead focus on a child's best interest as the paramount consideration. In the instance case, contrary to what opposing counsel for appellants argued, the district court did consider the sibling preference, as they should have, while analyzing each of the 10 best interest factors under Minnesota Statute 260C.212, Subdivision 2B. The district court did not take the consideration of the sibling preference lightly.
Counsel, did the district court in this case properly or fully consider the testimony of expert Gordon? I don't see much discussion of Gordon's testimony in the district court's order, and that testimony related to the importance of sibling bonds.
Your Honor, it would be our position that the district court was not required to make significant findings with respect to Ms. Gordon's testimony. Findings of fact shall not be set aside unless clearly erroneous, and due regard shall be given to the opportunity of the district court to judge the credibility of a witness. When there is conflicting testimony, the district court's decision is based on a determination of witness credibility. Here, the district court heard the testimony of Ms. Gordon, but as noted throughout our brief, there was significant conflicting testimony that Ms. Gordon provided. On the one hand, she was saying that a transfer should be made from my client's care to the appellant's care for JB. On the other hand, she was saying that we should minimize the amount of transfers made at all possible. That is just one example of many instances where Ms. Gordon's testimony was conflicting, and therefore the district court properly determined that Ms. Gordon did not provide credible testimony and therefore was not required to include that in its findings. That then turns to the issue of whether the district court abused its discretion by making findings unsupported by the evidence. In addition to what I just indicated, appellants seem to be attempting to argue that the district court's findings are not supported at all by the evidence, and that the district court failed to include significant findings regarding the testimony of appellants as well as their expert. Here, the district court made detailed findings in the analysis of each of the best interest factors, all of which are supported by the evidence presented. Numerous exhibits and credible testimony was also provided by the social workers, the guardian ad litem, respondents, JB's maternal relatives, and the county's expert witness to support each of the findings in the district court's analysis of the best interest factors. Many of the allegations made throughout appellant's briefs, as well as the arguments today, are not supported by the record, whereas the findings made by the district court are in fact supported by the record. Based on this, the court did not abuse its discretion and provided findings that are supported by evidence that is shown in the record. I note that my time is almost up, so I would like to say in sum that I agree with Ms. Christensen's arguments that the district court properly found that the county was reasonable in its efforts. The district court also properly applied the law with respect to the Foster Care Sibling Bill of Rights. Even if, however, the district court had found that the county was unreasonable and or that these rights did not apply here, this does not negate the fact that the child's individual best interests are paramount. And that is exactly what the court did here, and they therefore did not abuse their discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And with that, we will turn back to counsel for the appellant, and you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. And feel free to adjust the podium, and then your time will begin when you are ready.
So tall. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to just address briefly this medical records question that has come up a couple times. I will turn the court to what was Exhibit 13 in the trial record. It is referenced also in our briefing, and they are emails with Ms. Ashley Holmes, who was the DHS worker. And the email chain actually started because the appellants, my client, sent an email to Ms. Holmes saying, "What is happening with the ICPC? It has been months and I've heard nothing." So Ms. Holmes then reached out to Ms. Walton, the worker. Ms. Walton did not reach out affirmatively ever to DHS about this. It was only once they reached out to her and said, "Hey, what's going on with this ICPC?" And she said, "I'm waiting for medical records. There's been a large delay. And by the time I obtained these records, the child's father came into the picture and is now asking to work a case plan." None of this is in the record. There's no other emails
asking for medical records. There are no other emails saying that there's a delay in processing. There's nothing in the written record to support this, nor is there anything in the record to say father is requesting a case plan. Father called and said, I want him with his sister. So again, it's one more representative moment of the misrepresentations that have been given over and over in this case by the county. And this court in CF found that one of the bases for finding a county unreasonable were repeated misrepresentations about what had been done and what had been done with the ICPC process. And that's exactly what we have here. I'd also note that there was no credibility finding about Ms. Gordon or about any of the witnesses for appellants. She was just pretty much ignored completely. Similarly, the testimony of both appellants, AC and RC, is almost completely missing from the court order. It is hardly referenced at all. And the fact that the maternal grandfather, who was a witness for the county, DS, I apologize, acknowledged that much of the estrangement that happened initially with the between AC and the maternal grandmother was due to the fact that maternal grandmother was angry that the county, Olmsted County, had placed the child in Colorado, and she was acting out because of it. That was in his own testimony. She never testified. But the court completely ignores the testimony of both appellants, of their expert, and of the 90-plus exhibits that were given at this trial. So I submit that the court did abuse its discretion in improperly applying the law, both to relative search efforts, which under 260C.221 require involvement, not just identification, but involvement of relatives in decision-making, in what's happening. Erroneously missed everything on the sibling placement preference and how the sibling placement preference is not a preference just because. It's a preference because it affects the best interests of our children, because children deserve to be placed with their closest family when that is possible.
There's so, counsel, if you could just help me understand. So the way I hear your argument is that the district court did not appropriately consider the sibling placement preference, but they also have this duty to make an individualized determination of the needs of that child and what their best interests are. So if you could just explain how the court erred in that way and how it should have balanced those two statutes, that would be helpful.
Yes, those two statutes are not separate sort of factors, right? The reason we have preferences for relatives or children is because we recognize that that is the best interest of the child in general to be placed in what is closest to their initial family home, right? And that is because the evidence bears out that that affects the multiple factors under best interests. So for example, the medical needs of the child, the developmental needs of the child, the child's community, the child's history, all of those things are affected by a sibling placement because, as Ms. Gordon testified about and as other states have recognized, the research shows us that children need that sense of protectiveness. They need that sense of, who am I? Who's this person that's experiencing this with me? They are always an adopted child. Their identity is in part as an adopted child. And when they have a sibling who has also been through that, that is the only other person in the world that understands, that can talk to them, that can work with them when they say, this is how I feel. Why am I in this position? Nobody else shares that experience. And that affects myriad pieces of the child's well-being, which are laid out in the factors. So that's why I submit that we have these preferences for a reason, not just because these are the people we like best, but because the evidence and the research has borne out that this helps children develop into healthier, more resilient adults with lower incidences of mental health impacts, with lower incidences of questions about who am I and where do I belong. And Ms. Gordon talked about that. The licensing agency in Colorado outlined that in the home study for the appellants, and other states have recognized this as well. So I would say that the court missed this by completely separating these two issues rather than looking at how this impacts the best interests of the child. And I am out of time. Thank you.
And there are no other questions, so thank you for your time. Thank you to all of the attorneys and to the parties for your time and the effort that you put into your argument here today in the briefing as well. This case will be submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame as required. So you may switch out to the next case. We have one last case on the calendar today. Thank you.